The weather is warming up. School will be letting out soon, and entertainment districts are hopping until the wee hours. A season of late-night mayhem is upon us. But when people stay out drinking, do they make plans to get home safely? I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll take a look at the factors that keep people from making safe decisions after a night out with friends. Does Kansas City have a particular culture around drinking and driving? And how do Kansas and Missouri laws play into the picture? As part of our Tell KCUR series, we'll check in on your ideas for making Kansas City a safer place to stay out late. That's on Central Standard right after this news. Good morning and welcome to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. In recent years, we've heard a lot more about texting and driving than we have about drinking and driving. But drunk driving is still prevalent, and it's still problematic. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, alcohol-impaired driving crashes account for nearly one-third of all traffic-related deaths in the United States. That's a harrowing statistic. Of course, everyone knows that drinking and driving is a bad idea. So why do people do it anyway, and what would it take to change the cultural norms? We'll begin this journey with bartender Scott Tipton. He's the manager at Manifesto, a late-night speakeasy-style bar downtown. Hi, Scott. I appreciate your joining us so early in the morning.
Yeah, thanks. Good morning. It is early.
Set the scene for us. It's the end of the night. People have been drinking as per the nature of a bar. What kinds of situations do you see unfolding before you as people disperse needing to get home?
Well, there's a variety. You know, I mean, everybody's different. Everybody's levels of intoxication or ability to digest alcohol are different. So you've got, you know, you've got couples who are seeking to get out of there and, you know, get a cab or maybe, you know, hop onto the next bar. And you've got families who are going home. You've got a variety of people, you know, definitely different levels as well of where they're at in their night.
Well, as a bartender or just a social person, when you see people in no shape to drive, reaching for their keys, what are your options? I mean, are there realistic solutions? I personally have found drunk people to be a little bit difficult to reason with on this subject. And in your case, a lot of the people you're observing are strangers.
I think the best way to interact is just to be honest, you know, without mincing words, you know, being direct, but just maybe let them know, kind of trying to be their friend. A lot of times drunk people, they want a friend. They want somebody to be nice to them and, you know, to kind of help them in that situation, not to be aggressive and push them in a certain direction or tell them what to do. So, you know, possibly just telling them, hey, you've had a little bit too much fun tonight. Because that's all they, in their mind at that point, that's what they've had is fun.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe let them know there's been too much fun tonight. So come back tomorrow. We'll be here and we'll start over again.
Yeah. Well, so can you give an example of a time, not naming any names, of course, when you've observed something and had a really positive interaction around changing someone's behavior?
For sure. I think, you know, behind the bar as a bartender, hospitality extends in so many ways. And part of that hospitality is taking care of your guest, you know, taking care of them as far as keeping their water full so that throughout the night, maybe the alcohol does absorb better. an experience might be helping somebody throughout the night that maybe has had too much to drink and letting them know that, hey, if you stick around for another hour, I'll give you a ride home afterwards. You know, I'll personally take you home or take you back to your hotel in a non-threatening, non-creepy way.
Have you done that?
It has happened. Yes.
Can you tell the story?
Yeah, there was a time where there was actually not that long ago, about 2 weeks ago. This one wasn't me in particular, but it was a fellow bartender who, the end of the night, who's married. Again, no names will be named, but a couple ladies were at the bar and they had probably had too much to drink and it was pretty evident. I think they knew it. We knew it. They were debating whether to drive back to their hotel or to get a cab. You could easily see the development of the conversation between them. And he very calmly was, you know, had become friends with them throughout the night, knew him by name and said, hey, if you guys stick around for a little bit longer, you know, we're about to get out of here. I'll get right back to your hotel. Just, you know, here's my wedding ring. I'm non-threatening. I'm non-creepy. And it happened. And everything was fine, and they made it home safely and got their car the next day and came in and were eternally grateful and became customers again later.
So have you spent much time in other cities?
Absolutely.
Do you think Kansas City has a particular relationship with this kind of behavior, or are the things you see in bars around town here fairly common nationwide?
I think as far as what you see in the bars are common, I think the difficulty and the difference in Kansas City versus other cities is just options, you know, transportation. We're working towards that, especially with the streetcar coming in downtown and things like that. But in other cities I've lived in and especially visited, you know, bigger metropolitan cities, you've got such better transportation options and it's easier. It's more convenient. I think a lot of times people in that situation are looking for convenience. So it's tricky, but there's differences for sure.
When you're listening to conversations like the one you were just recounting, the two women are discussing their options, considering whether they should get a cab or just take their chances and drive to the hotel. What are the pros and cons you typically overhear?
The pros are, again, convenience of having their car the next day, of being able to wake up and get back in the car and go where they're going. The con is money, and you know, is it worth it to call a cab? You know, they at that time it seems like that $30 or $40 is so important, when in reality, as we all well know, the negative impact coming from there if a DUI does happen is so severe that it's not thought about at that exact moment.
What is the role of the bartender in all this? Do you see yourself as having any particular responsibility, or are customers' decisions kind of ultimately their own? I mean, there's only so much you can do, and you know, your job is really, is it just to serve the drink, or is there something else? Do you see yourself having a special role?
I think so. Back to the hospitality, I think it does extend, you know, as far as you are able to let it extend. I mean, maybe it might be too much to take somebody home every night, and you know, that might be a little bit more than the job requires, and there's honestly probably liability there in a lot of ways that, you know, legally that we probably is a different conversation. But as much as you can do as far as, you know, offering water and offering to call a cab and having cab numbers handy and doing whatever you can do, I think there's a role there for sure that as far as you were able to take it, you know, is for the best.
Well, Scott Tipton of Manifesto, thank you so much for sharing those insights. And now we're going to change gears a little bit. We're going to go from the bar at the end of a festive night to the road where our revelers are on their way home. Here to guide us through that part of the journey is Chris Mann from the Kansas Advisory Board for Mothers Against Drunk Driving, more commonly known as MAD. Hi, Chris. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thank you.
So you've been personally affected by a collision with a drunk driver in a pretty significant way. Could you tell us that story?
Sure. It was back in 2002. I was a police officer in Lawrence, Kansas. I had pulled over a car about 3 o'clock in the morning. It was outside of my patrol vehicle when I saw the flash of headlights and was struck by a drunk driver while I was outside the car. I recovered enough from those injuries to come back to the road two separate occasions, but the injuries eventually took over and I wasn't able to stay on the road. My leg and back weren't able to support the belt and the running and things that were necessary. So I was forced to take a medical retirement from the police department and basically had to essentially reinvent myself at that point, find out what I was going to do, because being a police officer was all I had ever known. I expected that I would eventually recover, that I would be back to normal, and that just hasn't happened. It's been almost 12 years, and I've recovered quite a bit. But I still deal with the pain each day in my leg and back and varying forms that occurred from that injury. So it's been a lifelong, so far, 12-year sentence for me that the drunk driver caused. And I, like I said, I've since found a new career and a new path. I've gone back to law school and am currently prosecuting, which I was lucky to be able to do, but to have to spend that time and the money and the effort to reinvent myself and lose the job that I really did love was a very difficult experience.
When you hear a conversation like the one that we're having today, I can't imagine that you don't hear it differently than you did before this accident. How did you view this stuff before getting in this accident?
Before the crash that occurred, I arrested drunk drivers. I saw them as someone who was committing a crime and someone that I could arrest and take to jail. But I didn't see the true penalties that came along to the victims of drunk drivers. I didn't see the long-standing pain or complications that victims were subjected to when they were struck by drunk drivers or even worse, killed by drunk drivers. It was when I was became a victim that I understood. I felt like I truly understood what the victims were going through, what the real ramifications of this crime are. And that's when I started working with Mothers Against Drunk Driving to try and educate others and inform others of how dangerous this is and just how life-altering it is for the victims that are out there. The statistics always talk about the fatalities nationwide, about 10,000 last year, but the injuries are more than 30 times that. More than 300,000 a year are injured by drunk drivers and have the same or similar story as mine, having to reinvent themselves, having to find new ways to do things. Fact is, before I was injured, I ran marathons. I haven't run a marathon since I was injured. And that's something that I struggle with every day. And I hope someday I'm able to do that again, but it's a difficulty that I continue to deal with.
Do you struggle with anger at all? I mean, thinking about that, are you able to find compassion for the person who made a bad decision, or is that just off the table?
Initially, there was quite a bit of anger when I was first injured. I've learned to deal with that. I've learned to understand that people make decisions for various reasons and that anger isn't going to solve that, that education, information, and helping people is going to be what solves that. We have to get the word out that these selfish actions, these choices that people make to drive drunk create problems for other people. Once people think of others ahead of themselves, ahead of their own convenience, I think that's going to help us move past this problem that we have.
When you mention education, I think back on maybe the 80s and maybe even the 90s, hearing a lot about a lot of campaigns against drinking and driving, you know, friends don't let friends drink and drive, that kind of stuff. I don't hear as much of it anymore. And I don't know if that's because maybe I'm less of the intended audience. You know, at that time I was growing up and forming my own ideas and being sort of more actively educated. But I don't know. I hear a lot more about texting and driving. Can you weigh in on that?
Sure. Texting and driving is obviously a problem, and it's causing a lot of accidents on our roadways. But like you said at the beginning, drinking and driving is still a problem. The reason that you've stopped hearing as many messages is that since 1980, since MAD was formed and started their public campaign, fatalities have decreased by over half. And with the decrease in that number has come a decrease in interest in pursuing that as we continue to get better and do more to help victims and to make there be less victims, the interest in the idea isn't as great. So we need to keep that interest alive, let people know that these statistics, these 10,000 people who are killed, the 300,000 plus who are injured, aren't just numbers. They're actual people out there who had lives and are trying to move on from that. They're actual friends, family members, coworkers out there that we have to remember are not just a number. And the more we're able to talk about it, the more we're able to get it on people's minds, the more we're going to be able to decrease the fatalities even more. Like you said, the education worked in the 80s and 90s when it was there, decreased fatalities in a huge way. I think that's going to be key to doing that again.
Well, as much as we don't want to talk about the numbers, do you know how bad the problem is in Kansas? And what do you think has made a difference and will make a difference?
In Kansas, we've seen a great reduction over the past couple of years. In 2011, I was part of a legislative group that helped to pass a first-time drunk driver ignition interlock device law. that required a ignition interlock device, a device that requires someone to blow into it below the legal limit before they're allowed to start their car. After that was passed, Kansas saw a 30% reduction in DUI fatalities over the next 2 years. So in 2012, a 24% reduction was seen. Only 98 people were killed by drunk drivers. And that was the first time it was below 100 people in the history of Kansas. As far as injuries, that same year there were 1,622 injuries by people in drunk driving-related crashes. The impact is beyond the personal as well. It hits every Kansan's pocketbook. It's estimated that the fatalities alone cost taxpayers $490 million in Kansas in 2012, and those injuries cost taxpayers and businesses even more money.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for sharing all of that information and your story with us, Chris. Chris Mann from Mothers Against Drunk Driving.
Thank you.
And now, having left the bar, we've left the bar, we've gotten on the road, and now we may encounter the law. Here to discuss the legal component of drinking and driving is Michael Hunt, Chief Trial Assistant for Eastern Jackson County. Hello, Michael.
Hello. So
how do DUIs work in Missouri? What are the legal repercussions for being caught drinking and driving?
Well, the legal repercussions are in Missouri, it's kind of a graduated approach. I think the goal is to try and shape behavior while we're trying to punish those who are guilty. Our legislature changed our laws just a few years ago in an effort to, as you get more DWIs, the punishments continue to go up. I think the theory was that if we show them the inside of a jail cell early on, we might be able to change these. Because, you know, as we were talking, you were talking earlier, it's the repeat offenders that are always coming back. But it really does just take one time to be out there drunk and someone's going to get injured.
Well, do the penalties differ when someone has been injured or killed as a result of the behavior, or is the behavior itself really at issue legally?
Well, it's a little bit of both. If you are in an intoxicated condition and you kill someone who is not in your car, that's a B felony. And you're going to do 85% of whatever time you get for that. It used to be, when I first started, it was a C felony. You could only get up to 7 years. But as you know, the legislatures have looked at this, it's in an effort to shape behavior again, that they're going to take this very serious.
Do laws shape behavior?
We hope so. I think it's, you know, it's seen over time that this type of crime can be shaped. The expense of getting a DWI, I think that deters people. The fact that hopefully, you know, if they get their first time and go in for 10 days in the Jackson County Jail, that's going to deter them, because the next time it's going to be 30. The next time it's going to be 60. And the next time they're going to be down in the Missouri Department of Corrections. So hopefully, you know, the goal is to say, look, you've got to stop this or we're going to put you in behind bars.
What about checkpoints? Do checkpoints work, and do we have any evidence of that one way or the other?
It's kind of hard to say. You know, checkpoints are good at catching those folks who are out there. They've, you know, they try and do them around nights that are going to be party nights. I was out at one in Lee Summit a few weeks ago, and, you know, there were a lot of people driving through there. You could tell that they were impaired, and we got them off the street. So I think they do work.
So the goal is to remove people from the street that night in that moment before they get any further.
Absolutely. Because what you want to do is take them off the street so before they can hurt somebody.
What do you do about something like, I mean, there are all sorts of mechanisms people use to warn one another about DUI checkpoints.
Absolutely. The night I was out there, you know, they were being told back at, you know, downtown Lee Summit, where the parties were going on, the word was getting out by social media that, you know, this was going on. One of the ways they can do it is pick up and move the checkpoint, move it around. But to be honest with you, it didn't really matter. They were being told, and these people were still just driving right on through.
Interesting. Well, how much of this issue is legislative and infrastructural, and how much of it is personal and cultural? I mean, it's interesting to me thinking about something like seatbelts. There was a time when it was seen as kind of like, lame and inconvenient to put on a seatbelt, and a lot of people didn't do it. Maybe they made their kids do it, but they didn't do it themselves. I remember trying to make my grandmother wear a seatbelt, and she was very resistant. Her shirts would be wrinkled. But now it's sort of automatic and normal to get in a car and put on a seatbelt for most people. Did laws change that behavior, or was it something else?
Well, I hope laws change that, and I hope that's what we can do with this, because these are not your hardened criminals. These are the folks that hopefully we can shape by making it, you know, with it, for lack of a better term, painful to go out there and drink and drive. Because, you know, I think that's something that does stop them. They go into the bars, and there's a reason why people, you know, have a designated driver, because they don't want to go through the expense and the time of getting a DUI.
Well, in December, there was an article in Time magazine, and it was preparing people for the new year. And Time magazine named the three best states to be drinking, and Missouri was voted the best. And it was, I'll just read this little blurb. "There's no better place in the country to get your drink on than the Show Me State. Missouri has no restrictions against open containers, and the only places it's illegal to be drunk in public are occupied schools, churches, or courthouses." What do you hear when you hear that? I mean, do you think that, I know that that's about drinking and not drinking and driving, but I wonder if, does Missouri have a special scenario going on?
Oh, I don't know that we have a special scenario. I think this happens other places. I think the fact that we are a driving community as opposed to some of the other communities that are not, I think that really influences the fact that, you know, people drive to bars and therefore they're going to drive home. It's kind of like you were talking about with the seatbelts. It's got to be a position where the culture is you drink, you just don't get behind the wheel.
You're on the law enforcement side of this. Do you have any exposure to what's going on the other side of it, on the side where people are making the decisions? What's your thought about that side of the issue?
Well, you know, again, it's hard for us. We're the reactionary part of it. We come in after they've already done it. But, you know, like I said, I think the goal is to influence that decision before it ever happens. What you want to be able to do is, you know, show them the punishment that if you do this, it's going to be very difficult on you. You could lose your job because you're going to be in prison.
That would make it hard to get to work.
Well, yes, it would.
Thanks so much, Michael. And before we conclude the first portion of today's show, we're going to hear what our listeners have been telling us all week about their ideas for curbing drunk driving in Kansas City. We'll get to that insight during our weekly Tell KCUR segment. So now I must sadly say goodbye to the guests who have been with us so far today, generously sharing their three different perspectives on this issue, Scott Tipton, Chris Mann, and Michael Hunt. Thanks so much for your time, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And now it's time for Tell KCUR. This week, we asked you what you thought Kansas City could do to curb drinking and driving. Here to share your answers is KCUR's Allison Rollitz. Hi, Allison.
Hi, Gina.
So what did you hear from the listeners on this, by and large?
Well, I would say out of all of our Tell KCUR questions, this is one of the first times that we really had a unanimous response. Almost everyone pointed to some need for public transportation services. And this call from Awad Ahmed, he really sums it up.
Okay, well, we'll maybe get that call later on. It's not available at the moment, but why don't you just summarize for us, Allison, what the caller said?
Sure. Awad just really talked about that if you want to curb drunk driving in Kansas City, that we really should have more bus and taxi services. You know, for example, a big part of this was social media, and Audrey, she tweeted us that we need more robots driving our cars home. Quote, she said, "No one wants to leave their car in Westport overnight or take a cab to bars from home." On Facebook, a gentleman named Mo, he just kind of laid it out a little bit more clearly. He said, "Taxis to and from the suburbs are exorbitant price-wise, and public transportation is not pervasive, especially at night when most alcohol is consumed. If people stopped drinking and driving, nightlife in this town would dry up overnight."
Well, it does seem logical that, you know, people have to get home somehow. And if you aren't going to get behind the wheel of a car, you're going to need other options.
Sure.
But public transportation can mean a lot of different things. Did people make specific recommendations about the form they'd like to see that solution take?
Yeah. We actually had a few people talk about light rail, and they're actually really interested in the Kansas City streetcar starting up, thinking that that might help some people. Emily in Kansas City, she tweeted us that she thinks the Kansas City Transportation Authority really should look into a trial run of more frequent bus routes on weekend nights. I don't think there's the expectation that they're going to be running till 3 a.m. during the week, but I think on weekends where a lot of the drinking is happening, I think there's a desire for that. Ashley got a little more specific with us on Twitter. She suggested a late night bus route specifically to Waldo on the weekends.
Any guess on your part about why she picked Waldo to single out?
The only guess I can make is that's just a really kind of up and coming community. A lot of young professionals are moving there. And I guess if young professionals are drinking, a route there might help.
What about something like walking?
Sure. On Twitter, a woman named Sarah, she suggested that instead of just creating more bus routes and more taxi services, that the city should just really invest in developing more walkable communities. She said, that way you can, quote, drink close to home and walk. You'd never have to worry about how much you've had.
What would it take, though, to make a community walkable at night as opposed to during the day? I mean, I'm thinking about things like I've lived in very walkable neighborhoods during the day, and I still didn't take advantage of that at night because there weren't always streetlights, for example.
Sure. You know, in my early 30s, I lived in Westport in Kansas City, and I walked Westport, you know, during the day all day, even through the evening. But late at night, if I didn't have someone with me, I wasn't going to the bars and walking by myself. But just to compare that, I also lived in downtown St. Joseph for a good chunk of my 20s, and not the bar scene that Westport has, but because I lived a block away from a lot of these places, and I felt relatively safe there, I was able to walk and get my drink on whenever I wanted.
Was there anything you expected to hear more of that you were surprised more people didn't suggest?
Actually, yeah. As a community engagement team, we talked a lot about how we expected more people to mention breathalyzers. You see that in the movies. You hear about that in court cases. But really, we just had a couple of tweets. I'll share one with you. Let's see, on Twitter, Jive says that he just thinks that any bar that's open till 3 a.m. needs to have a breathalyzer.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Any outliers on this, or was it all public transportation all the time?
It was mostly transportation all the time, but I would like to share with you, we did receive a call from Raymond. He called in a more radical solution to curb drinking and driving in Kansas City. He thinks the city should publicly shame drunk drivers at the plaza, he really thought that would be a way to, if we publicly shame them, possibly, quote, flogged them,
wow,
then as a society, we'd be less likely to have people drinking and driving. So that was one outlier.
Little extreme, but interesting.
Yes.
Any other outliers, or is that where you'd sort of...
You know, we had a few people that said if we emphasized education more, that would help. We had some people really kind of tap into spirituality. Really just if, as a culture, if we educated people more about the signs of drunk driving or the signs of being drunk and maybe just preventing being drunk in the first place, then that could help curb drunk driving. But most of the responses, by and large, really called on an increase in bus services and late night taxi services in Kansas City.
Well, thanks so much, Allison. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, Gina. Likewise.
We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be ready for your calls. Tell us what you've observed. Do you think Kansas City has a cavalier attitude toward drinking and driving? We want to hear from everyone, but especially people who have lived in other places, to get a frame of reference. The number to call is 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Central Standard will return in a minute. Good morning and welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. Earlier in today's show, I met with people in our community who have had firsthand experience with both cause and effect when it comes to drinking and driving. Now we're ready to take your calls. Here to speak with you when you dial 816-235-2888 is Clancy Martin, one of the ethics professors who regularly appears on Up to Date. Clancy recently wrote an article for Harper's Magazine about the gap between what we profess to be our moral code and how we actually behave in real life. Hi, Clancy.
Hi, Gina. Thanks for having me.
So give us some philosopher's perspective on the gap between what we know to be sort of the morally ideal behavior and what we actually do.
Well, I think it's particularly acute, actually, when it comes to this question of the use of alcohol in our culture. Because on the one hand, we do have a very strong and kind of appropriate, especially in the context of drinking and driving, widespread moral condemnation of this practice. I think we are entirely right to do everything we can, obviously, to prevent drunk driving and these days driving while under other kinds of impairment for which we don't yet have adequate testing. You know, William S. Burroughs famously said that he'd drive drunk any day of the week, but one thing he would never do was drive after smoking weed because the impairment that he suffered was so much more severe. But we don't have adequate testing right now for police officers when it comes to the question of pulling over somebody who, you know, we don't have a breathalyzer for pot yet.
Interesting. And there's no way to test that just on the spot?
They don't have an adequate means yet, no. So it's going to be a big, big issue in the coming years, and probably some tech company is going to make a lot of money off of it. But be that as it may, so we have this widespread moral, even and appropriate indignation over drunk driving and related behaviors. On the other hand, we have a culture where, as we all frankly admit, and we heard people talking about very casually, we expect people to sort of be getting drunk on a regular basis, getting drunk on the weekends. It is one of the it is perhaps the most common recreational evening activity that we have. And yet, as our callers also pointed out, we don't take sensible provisions like excellent public transportation to provide for people after they've imbibed too much alcohol or whatever other substance. So we do have this weird cultural disconnect, this cognitive dissonance between what we think is radically inappropriate behavior and what we nevertheless practice and what we are willing to do about it.
This dissonance is both particular to the issue at hand and sort of something that exists in our minds and in our societies more broadly and throughout time. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah, that's right. It's not just we're not just hypocrites when it comes to the question of drinking and how we deal with drinking and driving in particular. I as a quick example, I was once at a party that was mostly judges and lawyers, and everyone was drinking too much. This was after I had quit drinking, so I wasn't drinking. But then they started a game, the lawyers and judges, of passing around a breathalyzer, a handheld breathalyzer, to see who was the most drunk. And these were all people who were planning on driving home, I should say. But it was a competition, you know. I mean, like, what's your blood alcohol? Oh, you've barely even gotten started yet. Let me show you mine, you know. I mean,
there is something a little macho about this.
Yeah, that's true. And in this particular example, there was something a little bit macho about it. It was mostly the boys, I have to say, and not the women in the room. It was the men and not the women. Who are sort of bragging about their level of drunkenness. And that's one thing that worries me about this otherwise seemingly sensible suggestion of having breathalyzers at bars, especially bars that stay open particularly late. And what I don't know if we talked about keys as much as maybe we should have. No, we're hypocrites about so many things. You know, the most common one is we have this extremely widespread moral indignation, let's say, that is reinforced by a moral condemnation, indignation adding moral condemnation of lying or teaching our children you never should lie. You often meet people who say, I never lie. They're very suspicious of liars. And yet the truth of the matter is, as many, many studies have shown, the average human being, the average adult human being lies once every 90 minutes.
That is frequent.
Yeah. And that's just average. You know, that's just very typical. Once every 90 minutes. I know it makes you want to just keep your mouth closed for a few weeks just so you can mess with the averages.
Absolutely.
But so I think in this particular instance, it's maybe unusually egregious because we drink so much and yet we get so indignant about it. But it applies to all areas of our moral life.
Let's hear from Sherry in Blue Springs. Hi, Sherry.
Hi. This is Sherry in Blue Springs, and I have a little bit of a different take. I am an attorney that defends people that have been drinking and driving under the influence, and I mostly represent a lot of young people that perhaps this is their very first time that they have ever had anything like this happen to them. And I just think that to some extent that the laws have become a little bit draconian. And what I see, I've been doing this for 20 years, is that it really is a mechanism for the state, the cities, to some extent the police officers. It's a money-making machine. I mean, it's really become a way, and again, I totally agree with the previous caller that we have this moral indignation about it, but on the other hand, the cities are more than welcome, the states and the cities and the prosecutor's office and the police, they're more than welcome to, more than eager to take, you know, these people's money and you know, you got to pay the tow truck driver, you got to pay the courts, you got to pay an attorney, you got to pay the probation service, you got to pay the ignition interlock people. I think that if all this went away, then, you know, there'd be a lot of people without jobs. And quite frankly, the young people I see that possibly have children, they might lose their job. And then you're going to have a mother or a dad without a job, and then you're going to have children without a parent, without any income, and then those people are going to go on state aid, and then it's going to cost the taxpayer money. I mean, it's what I never understood against mothers, against drunk drivers, is how many people they put out of jobs, young people that make mistakes, and then there's children that are affected by that because
either
dad doesn't pay child support.
This is an interesting point, and I want to give Clancy a chance to respond to you, because on a moral, from a moral standpoint, this issue of, well, it's a first offense and this person's getting this severe penalty, but on the other hand, the repercussions of this person's actions could be lethal. How do you sort this out from a moral perspective, and how does the money involved kind of distort how it works and how we perceive it?
Well, I think Sherry is exactly right. I agree both with the overall tenor of her remarks, and I think I agree with her in just about every particular. Where she's taking us is to a recognition that this is a social problem. Rather than, a problem of sort of finding the appropriate punishment. Now, sometimes when it comes to particularly short-term solutions to widespread social problems, we have to be more creative than we have been so far. And so there are, particularly with emerging technologies, there are solutions that we can use that would save everybody money, that would save the society money, that would keep people in their jobs, but would also deal with the fact that, contrary to what Sherry suggested, in my own long experience as a member of AA and as a recovering alcoholic myself, in my own long experience of talking to people who are alcohol abusers and consequently in this area usually have both been drunk and been driving. Anyone who tells you, oh, I got busted the very first time I got drunk and driving, they're not being truthful with you. They've probably gotten drunk and driven many times before they were actually caught at it, because you really have to be, as a rule, pretty messed up before a policeman will pull you over. So solutions. Well, we have these devices that can be attached to cars. They could be attached to cars much more quickly to prevent you from starting your own car until you breathe into a breathalyzer. The problem with those is that they're expensive, and the burden falls entirely on the drinker, and many people would say it should, But if we had social support for that, we'd actually probably wind up saving society a lot of money. We have scram anklets. We have new portable devices that you can be forced to be tested at particular times. SoberLink is one company. Scram is another. We have a whole host of new technologies that could be applied that would be less expensive both for the courts, for individuals, and if there were grants for people who really didn't have the money to do this, if there was social support, we could come up with solutions that were much cheaper and didn't result in all of these costs that Sherry is correctly bringing our attention to.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM, streaming live at kcur.org. I'm Gina Kaufman here with Clancy Martin, who's both a professor of philosophy and a prolific writer. We're talking about drinking and driving from a moral, philosophical, and really practical standpoint. We'd love to hear from you. 816-235-2888. We've got Greg in Kansas City on the line. Hi, Greg.
Hello, how you doing? I just want to thank Clancy, you know, for bringing up, you know, that we have a, you know, we do have a cultural problem here, and disconnect between, you know, the drinking culture, you know, and Kansas City, you know, there's a lot of driving that has to be done in Kansas City to get to the bars from the suburbs, downtown, and surrounding areas. And, you know, I think that there's a problem, you know, because in culturally, alcoholism and drinking is so popular right now. It's just bombarded on the, you know, TV, movies, radio. And people,
yeah,
you know, are going to drink, and it's, you know, promoted, and that's how people make money. And, you know, it's not going to stop. And, you know, I have empathy for your first guest who got injured and the lawmaker guy, but, you know, there's a lot of hypocritical ideas going on because, you know, there's a lot of cops out there that drink and drive, and there's a lot of drinking and driving going on, and they're treating these people, that first-time offense people. Now, don't get me wrong. I mean, there's horrible accidents and deaths and stuff, but, you know, people make mistakes.
Okay,
you know?
Well, and, Greg, thank you so much for that.
Here real quick. And, you know, people do make mistakes, and, you know, the law right now is treating people like they're, you know, these monsters, when everybody knows that people drink and drive, man. You know, and so there needs to be a little bit more a solution to this, you know, weekends of drinking and driving, which I think mass transit should start to play a role in it.
Thanks so much, Greg. And go ahead and take one more caller before getting Clancy's response to this. We're going to talk now to Molly in Kansas City. Hi, Molly.
Hi there.
Hi, Molly.
I just wanted to talk a little bit about my experience living in Germany the past 6 years and what I've learned there. And, for example, it's extremely unacceptable to be caught drunk driving. You will lose your license immediately, and people are pretty much shamed if, you know, by your friends, by your family, if you're caught doing this, especially since the public transportation is so great. To not take advantage of that is pretty ridiculous. And, and they really, really take driving seriously. Obviously, with parts of the highway not having speed limits, it's huge to be very responsible. Wow.
Well, Molly, Germany, I mean, I don't mean to stereotype, but I have an association with Germany and beer. So this disconnect people are talking about between a culture that embraces drinking and then condemns drinking and driving. What is your perspective on that, having lived in Germany?
Well, that's very, very true. They love their beer and drink a lot. But I think they're also very, very responsible about it. So you can drink at age 14, but they don't drink to get drunk. They like the taste of beer. Sometimes they do get drunk, obviously, but they're going to be smart about how they're getting home. And another thing that's really, really huge in Germany, which people wouldn't ever dream of doing here, is alcohol-free beer. That's a huge market in Germany, and that's almost like a Diet Coke. They drink that just as heavily as they drink normal beer. So they enjoy the taste of the beer, and it's not necessarily to get drunk.
Well, thanks for that call, Molly. Clancy, quick response to these callers?
Yes. To the second caller, I agree entirely. I lived in Denmark for a while, which has one of the highest rates of alcoholism in the world. And yes, there was lots and lots of drinking in Denmark, but there was zero tolerance for drinking and driving. But there could be zero tolerance for drinking and driving because they had extremely good public transportation. I mean, I agree with the caller. It'd be a matter for public shaming, and you really could kind of become an outcast if people found out that you were drinking and driving. But it's because there were such good and obvious alternatives, and everybody used them. That is not the case here. When I was once in a DUI class in Overland Park, Kansas, the police officer who came to talk to us basically told us, here are the strategies to successfully drive drunk in Overland Park. These are the areas where the cops are going to be. These are the areas where the cops won't be. And there are particular bars and bar areas in Overland Park where restaurants, bars, and movies gather together in these complexes. And the police officers naturally gather around those areas, especially Thursday, Friday, Saturday nights. And that's where they pick up their drunk drivers. And that's what we were informed about. And I think he was just trying not to be too tough on the people in the room. But effectively what he did was give us a seminar on how to successfully drink and drive. So I have to say, and then speaking to the caller before and about it, it does relate to the hypocrisy that the caller before was talking about. I mean, as long as we are going to be, and it looks like we will be, a culture where one of our primary forms of entertainment is getting drunk together, we have to be more creative about dealing with this problem, because dealing with it purely by punishing the people involved, you only catch them after they're already drunk and on the road. And once they're drunk and on the road, they're dangerous. So we have to think of creative ways of keeping them from getting in the car in the first place.
Thank you, Clancy. Let's hear from Alan, who is just driving through the state. Hi, Alan.
Hi.
You've pulled over, right?
Yes, I'm pulled over.
Okay, great.
I'm driving through your wonderful state here in the rain. But up in Wisconsin, where I'm from, the tavern leagues have obviously wanted to keep a good image for themselves. And what they've done is encouraged bars to have designated driver programs. You end up with some sort of strap on your wrist, and you get free soda all night, but you're not allowed to be served a single alcoholic beverage.
A sensible solution. And if something, if that were regulated, let's say, rather than merely encouraged, I think that could be one really smart way to take a baby step in the right direction.
Alan, do people take advantage of that a lot? Is it common for people to say?
Yeah. So definitely. You always end up having like one or two friends who either are a little bit short on cash or just don't like drinking as much as the others, and they come out, spend time with their friends, maybe go to a pub quiz night or something, and they're the ones who are driving. Plus, you're all saving gas money.
Well, thanks so much for that call, Alan.
Yeah. Have a good day.
Thanks. That's an interesting perspective. Clancy, does that jive with your sense of moral philosophy?
Well, I think it's a great practical it's one great practical suggestion. I think it's going to take a variety of different things. But yeah, if somehow or other a bar could be rewarded for implementing this sort of policy and enforcing it, that would be fantastic. Or if we regulate it in some way, certainly I do think we haven't talked about the accountability of bars and bartenders. When it comes to this question, there are very good bartenders on this issue, and then there are also very irresponsible bartenders on this issue. The person providing the alcohol also has a really significant role in the question of inebriation and cultural alcoholism.
Well, you know, our bartender who was on earlier in the show did talk about this idea of stewardship. Maybe you could address that a little bit. I mean, where does that begin and end, especially when there are strangers who might be intimidated by the idea of getting in a car with you?
Right. I mean, obviously, a bartender's responsibility kind of, you know, only goes as far as the limits of the bar. And good bartenders will recognize, and they usually are seasoned bartenders, when a person is drunk, and they'll cut them off. They're not in a position to demand this person's keys. But I think the notion, strongly reinforcing the notion of stewardship within the culture of bartenders, would also be one of these little baby steps in the right direction of getting drunk drivers off the road. I mean, there's nothing wrong with and many bartenders, anyone who's been drunk will have had a bartender ask her or him, hey, are you driving tonight? You know, asking their friends too, making sure that a solution has been provided for this person is obviously drunk, is an important job for a bartender to do.
Well, we have time to just very, very quickly hear from Brad in Overland Park. And Brad, I'm sorry, but we're just going to have to go out on your call. So quick input from you, Brad.
Yes. Addressing the issue of you should follow the money. And one caller said that taxis from Overland Park or from the hot spots to Overland Park would help. Well, I think that the people who benefit from drunk drivers should pay to subsidize or even pay for that. And that's the plaintiff's attorneys, who get 40% of, let's say, $1 million fee whenever they have a drunk driving case for somebody who was killed.
Well, that's certainly another interesting idea, and we could have probably gone on forever with this. Thank you so much, Brad, in Overland Park, for that idea. The time has run out on our conversation about drinking and driving. I'd like to thank all of our guests and callers today, including Clancy Martin, who you can hear regularly on Up to Date during visits with the ethics professors. Thanks, Clancy.
Thanks so much, Gina.
Tune in tomorrow for Central Standard Friday. Host Russ Simmons will join his fellow movie critics to get reviews of the latest films, plus a discussion of religious parables translated for the silver screen. That's tomorrow at 10. Our show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton with help from Christy Garten, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Kate Baxendale. Linda Scher is our announcer. I'm Gina Kaufman, and you've been listening to Central Standard.